This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we discuss the next phase of the anti-war movement and upcoming actions marking the 12th anniversary of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. But first, on January 31st, the Washington Post published a story on their front page that revealed the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency had carried out a meticulously planned terrorist car bombing in Damascus, Syria. To speak about the significance of this story and what it means, we have on Richard Becker, author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. So it's been almost 7 years since the bombing actually took place. Why would the CIA leak the story now?
Well, I think that's a critical question. And the CIA has generally not revealed or deigned not to comment on things like this. And so we have to ask that question, is that why would they do this? And I don't think it's accidental. I think this is a deliberate leak of information, so-called, to the Washington Post. And then the Washington Post put it all over the front page of its newspaper, the entire front page above the fold on January 31st. So it's a very significant story. And we believe that the reason that the CIA would release this information and the Washington Post would print it is tied to a factional struggle that's going on inside the U.S. Ruling class and the ruling political circles over the issue of Iran and the negotiations that are going on, very intense negotiations that are going on in regard to Iran's nuclear program, its nuclear power program. And of course, the operation that was carried out against Imad Mughniyeh, who is a top leader of Hezbollah, the assassination that took place, very meticulously, carefully planned, that involved a number of different countries. The Hezbollah organization is allied with Iran, and both Iran and Hezbollah are assisting, are giving military assistance and other assistance to the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And that secular government of Assad is facing an armed uprising, an armed rebellion that controls large parts of the country now, and in which the main organizations are the ISIS, the Islamic State, and the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. So we have to see this in that connection, that this attack and the publicizing 7 years later, as you said, of this attack on Hezbollah appears to us to be an attempt to provoke a response from Hezbollah in order for the forces inside the U.S. ruling class who don't want these negotiations with Iran to go forward and to succeed, to give them another pretext to oppose them. And there's very strong opposition. And it's important to note that the Obama administration wants the negotiations to go forward, not because it sympathizes in any way with the Iranian government, but because they see this as a means by which to weaken Iran. They've already got extreme sanctions against Iran, which are hurting Iran a great deal economically. And they're hoping that they can weaken Iran's position and break this alliance that exists. The other side in the U.S. ruling class, and the ones who are probably responsible for leaking this report, don't want that to happen. They want to impose greater sanctions on Iran. And if they succeed in imposing greater sanctions on Iran, Iran has made it clear, the Iranian government has made it clear, that that will be the end of the negotiations. If that is the end of the negotiations and there are new sanctions against Iran, that must be seen as a step in the direction of war, against a wider war, and including military means against Iran. Clearly, the Israeli government wants that, the Netanyahu government wants it, and there are strong forces within the U.S. ruling circles who want it as well.
There's such a switch in protocol, this unusual leak by the CIA. Why now?
Yeah, well, I think that's the question. We see a number of things coming together which make that make sense. I don't think this is any kind of a conspiracy theory. There was the Hezbollah, people who are close to Hezbollah and in Lebanon, recognize it immediately for what it is. And we mentioned their comments in the article that we did on this, but that they say, you know, you can see that this is in connection with this, the fact that the negotiations with Iran are at a critical juncture. And it's expected that either there will be an agreement by the end of March or early April, or the negotiations may come to an end. So those who want to ratchet up the hostility even more in the direction of a new war against Iran are taking steps now, including the release of this story about the killing of one of the top people in Hezbollah by the U.S. and Israelis together. They're pulling out the stops to try to derail the negotiations and prevent them from reaching an agreement.
Right, and it's almost like a taunting or a provocation directly at Hezbollah. Can you go into more why that shakeup of Hezbollah would so much affect the situation?
Well, yes, it is. I think that it is. I think that they're throwing it in Hezbollah's face, and we have to see this in connection with other things that are happening at the same time. On January 18th, the Israeli military launched a cross-border attack into Syria. And in that attack, they killed six members of Hezbollah who, as I said, are there, you know, giving assistance, giving aid to the Syrian government. And another commander of Hezbollah was in the car that was hit by a missile and killed. And so was one of the sons of the man who was assassinated in 2008. Imad Mughniyeh, his son Jihad Mughniyeh, was one of the people killed. And also killed in this attack was a top Iranian officer, an Iranian general, who was in Syria. So you see that happen, and then 2 weeks later, a little under 2 weeks later, we have this report that comes from that appears on the front page of the Washington Post and is broadcast all over the world. And one analyst, a professor in Lebanon, said that, you know, that this is putting Hezbollah in an extremely difficult position, that it's being made public that they're being targeted by the United States as well as Israel. And that information can put them into a corner, as he put it, you know, that either they don't respond because they understand that this is part of a strategy, a tactic to derail the negotiations with Iran, or they do react and then maybe play into that agenda. So if they don't react, then it could be interpreted by some, although I don't agree with that, but as a sign of weakness. I think that the Hezbollah leadership has been very tactically smart over the years, and so they see what's going on, but it's, inflicting casualties on their organization, and this being carried out by the joint action of those two countries, which they see is really in many ways who they're really confronting, the Israel and the United States.
And anti-Iranian Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has been invited to a lecture of the joint session of Congress, which is highly unusual, is a breach of protocol. What are your thoughts on this? And also, too, to wrap up, too, before we're running out of time, what should we be doing here in the U.S., progressives, and trying to counteract this?
Well, yeah, and that's another piece of the puzzle, and we have to see the pieces and how they fit together, is that the invitation was by John Boehner, who's the Speaker of the House, to the head of government, not exactly the head of state, but the head of government in Israel, who is Benjamin Netanyahu, who is an extreme right winger, trying to confiscate as much Palestinian land as possible, and who has been speaking over and over and over again in the loudest possible way, calling for a new war, for new military action against Iran. So he's being brought to Congress to speak in favor of even greater sanctions against Iran by Boehner and by other forces who don't want the negotiations with Iran to go forward and do not want them to succeed. This has caused a huge controversy because, as you said, it is a violation of typical protocol where that would have to go through the White House, the invitation of the head of another government to come to the United States. But that didn't happen. They made it clear. Boehner did this the morning after, immediately after the State of the Union message, as an attack on the Obama administration's policy. And as I said, that policy is not a pro-Iranian policy or anything like that. So we expect that at the joint session of Congress where Netanyahu speaks, if he goes through with this, despite all the controversy and opposition he's getting both inside Israel and the United States for what is viewed as an election stunt in many ways, that it's just 2 weeks before the Israeli elections, next Israeli elections. Well, people will be outside. The Answer Coalition and many other organizations will be outside Congress to protest, to say no new war against Iran, end the colonial occupation of Palestine, and stop U.S. aid, all U.S. aid to Israel. And here in San Francisco, we'll be doing the same thing on that day, March 3rd.
You're tuned into Liberation Radio, and you can check out our website, liberationradio.org, on Facebook at facebook.com/Liberation Radio Show, and on Twitter at the handle Liberation Radio. Starting March 18th, a series of events will take place that culminate in a rally and march on Saturday, March 21st, in Washington, D.C., marking the 12th anniversary since the 2003 invasion of Iraq and opposing the ongoing U.S. war, which has been recently restarted in a new form. To update us on this next stage of the anti-war movement, we have on Sarah Sloan, National Staff Coordinator of the Answer Coalition. All right, Sarah, so Answer has been working since 2002 against the war in Iraq that allegedly ended in 2010. Obama, who previously quote-unquote ended the war, has now launched a new bombing campaign against the Islamic State. Before we talk specifically about the plans for March 18th to the 21st, what's ANSA's view of the campaign against IS?
Well, to understand it, we have to look at the different kind of components or the different sectors of the U.S. ruling class and what their view is with regard to Iraq and Syria and the Islamic State. President Obama represented a particular wing within the government or within the U.S. ruling class who desired to end the war in Iraq once and for all. And that's why he negotiated an agreement to leave Iraq in December 2011. But there's others, including John McCain, including sectors within the Pentagon, also including parts of the State Department, perhaps also Hillary Clinton, who are to the right of Obama, who are finding a way to maintain permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq under the guise, of course, of protecting Iraq. So when the Islamic State gained so much momentum in 2014, when they were threatening the city of Mosul, which is in the north, when they threatened to take over some of Iraq's central oil fields, the United States treated that as a threat to its strategic assets. And it's important to note that even though there are these different currents who had different views about the U.S. involvement in Iraq, there's a consensus or an understanding amongst all of them that there are certain assets that are considered to be invaluable to the fortunes of U.S. imperialism. And that includes control over significant parts of Iraq, especially the northern part of Iraq, the Kurdish area, Baghdad itself, meaning the central government, and also including Jordan. So when it looked like the Islamic State was on the offensive, when it looked like they were prepared to perhaps threaten the strategic interest, assets of the United States in Iraq, then Obama and his wing agreed with those who were demanding that the United States go in and they stop the Islamic State offensive. So on one level, this military response by the White House is a direct response to the threat and takeover to that which they considered strategically important. But at the same time, now that they've carried out this military response, and they're recognizing that they can't send boots on the ground to defeat the Islamic State. They can't do that because the American people won't tolerate, they won't accept the sending of tens or hundreds of thousands of ground troops into Iraq, like what happened in 2003. So in this situation, the U.S. government can, and they have, used the Islamic State offensive as a pretext for the re-intervention of the U.S. into Iraq. And that means not just an air war, but setting up of division headquarters in multiple cities. And that means permanent bases. That means what that other wing of the ruling class really has always wanted. So from our perspective, when we look back, when we see the big picture, what we can see has happened is that the U.S. invasion of Iraq really broke the country apart. Their occupation strategy, their strategy of funding militias along ethnic and religious lines, broke Iraq apart as a unitary entity. And because of that, because it's been broken apart, the United States lost control of the outcome of the situation. But it also meant, while it was no longer under U.S. control, that they could use the new chaos created by the fragmentation to do what Bush wanted, what Cheney wanted, which was to set up these permanent bases and to use them for endless war. So for our part, we say that the United States, that U.S. imperialism, created the circumstances that gave rise to the Islamic State. What they're doing now, dropping bombs on Iraqi cities, isn't possibly going to solve the problem of the Islamic State. It's only going to fuel the flames of the right-wing Islamic parties who are trying to use this crisis for their own political and military agenda. But under no circumstances should the people of the United States accept a new expanded war in Iraq, in Syria, or anywhere else. So our view really is, and what we're going to be talking about further here, is the need to build a new anti-war movement to oppose this new U.S. intervention just as strenuously as we opposed the U.S. intervention, the invasion and ground war that Bush carried out in 2003.
Right. So can we go into what's the plan actions between March 18th and the 21st?
Yes. The Anti-Coalition is part of a large number of groups who are mobilizing for spring mobilization. This March, of course, marks the anniversary of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. This is going to be the 12th year after that invasion took place. And in many years, it was marked by large demonstrations against the war and then against the continuing occupation of Iraq. And so this is an opportunity, and it follows a meeting that took place in Washington, D.C. on January 10th of many different anti-war and social justice organizations to try to revive the anti-war movement, to bring people together to oppose the new U.S. war in Iraq, to oppose U.S. intervention in Syria and elsewhere. And so there's a kind of exciting calendar of activities planned starting midweek on March 18th and then culminating in a protest at the White House and a march on Saturday, March 21st. So early in the week, there's going to be activities that are initiated by Cindy Sheehan and her group, the Soapbox People's Network, including on the 18th, a peace gathering and fellowship. On the Thursday, the 19th, there's going to be lobbying. And then there's going to be a tour of the war machine where buses are going to take people to demonstrate at various homes and offices of war criminals, which, of course, exists all over the D.C. area, including in downtown D.C. and in Maryland and Virginia, where many of them live. Then on Friday, March 20th, there's going to be a teach-in in the afternoon and evening, and this is going to be a great opportunity to further examine and learn more what's really happening in Iraq with the Islamic State and what the kind of U.S. intentions are, and more discussion on that in the anti-war movement. And then, as I said, this all culminates in a protest at the White House on Saturday, March 21st, which is going to be followed by a march. There's a number of different groups, as I mentioned, coming together for these activities. The Anti-Coalition is supporting it. Cindy Sheehan was the original initiator of the week of activities. And there's a number of others, including World Can't Wait, Code Pink, the National Campaign for Nonviolent Resistance, Veterans for Peace, March Forward, Military Families Speak Out, Witness Against Torture, and as I said, many others. People can go to the Answer Coalition website, where we have a post called Spring Rising, an Anti-War Intervention in D.C., where you can learn more, and that's at answercoalition.org.
So kind of what you were alluding to before about, you know, public opinion being heavily against the occupation of Iraq, we don't see that same kind of enthusiastic opposition to the new bombing campaign. How do you account for that, and how does ANSWER hope to address that?
Well, there's several major factors that are influencing and shaping public opinion and how people in the United States view the new bombing campaign in Iraq and Syria. And those, of course, are the factors that we, the anti-war movement, have to confront, have to analyze and deal with and help explain to people. A big one is that President Obama promised from the beginning that there would be no boots on the ground. Of course, this isn't really true. There are several thousand boots on the ground right now. But what he meant, what he was really promising, is that in this new intervention, all of the bleeding will be done by the Iraqi people. He was promising not to send thousands of young U.S. soldiers to kill and be wounded, just as happened in 2003. He was promising that this war was going to be a one-sided war. It was going to be a high-tech massacre of the Iraqi people. And, of course, that has a significant impact on consciousness in the United States, because people are shielded from the direct suffering of the war when they're not the one who bombs are being dropped on, and they don't even have friends and family members or themselves potentially involved and impacted directly by that war. The other big factor is that the policies of the Islamic State are so heinous, they're so disgusting, they're so brutal and barbaric and backwards, that they're a very easily demonized entity. And there is this kind of near universal revulsion to their policies. And so many people look at that and say, we must do something to stop them. So our job is to show what is really happening. And a big indicator of that is if you look at the new budget request. President Obama in this new budget asked for $51 billion specifically for this war in Iraq and Syria. $51 billion, that's about $1 billion a week. It's almost $200 million a day. And that's specifically for this. It's on top of the $550 billion that's part of the regular military budget. So even though the people in the United States are shielded from the actual suffering of this new war because of this no boots on the ground policy, they're still paying a very direct and heavy price because, of course, that money, those billions and billions of dollars, doesn't come from the corporate coffers. It comes from desperately needed social programs. Everyone knows that, you know, that's the part of the budget that's going to get cut to pay for war and intervention. So we want to condemn the war. We want to point out that it was the U.S. who armed and who aided the Islamic State in the case of Syria until it got out of control there. We want to, on political and moral grounds, oppose endless war, oppose the bombing of people around the world. And we also want to make this link, this direct link to people in the United States, that the billions for this war are being taken from socially necessary programs here. So it's not easy, but we're doing everything we can to shift consciousness, and we want to use all these different arguments and these explanations in order to do that.
Right, and going towards the shifting of consciousness, there seems to be a contradiction in the fact that just a year ago, the U.S. was funding many of these groups involved in the war, like you were speaking to. But now there's no talk about, I mean, now there's all this talk about IS being a big threat and how it's public enemy number one. How do people understand the contradictory foreign policy that plays itself out in the Middle East?
Well, that's absolutely right, that on its face, U.S. policy seems to, you know, all sense of logic to be completely contradictory. If you think back to the fall of 2013, when the Obama administration was threatening a new war in Syria, no one mentioned one word about the Islamic State, about the danger posed in Syria by the Islamic State. The whole thing at that time was that Assad must go. All of the United States focused their condemnation on the Syrian government who were fighting against the same armies from the Islamic State that the U.S. says now constitute an existential threat to the U.S. So what explains all this? You could say it's short-sightedness, hubris, incoherent policy, and arrogance of power. That would all be true, but it's not the entire story. The rich and powerful, those who make these imperialist moves, some of which backfire and have unintended consequences, those people are never held accountable. And so you see that it was the war in Libya, it was the funding of the civil war in Syria, all by the United States, that made the existence and the rise of the Islamic State possible. And now, having created this monster, the U.S. says we have to go back into Iraq and Syria in order to defeat it. And so it's completely contradictory, and it's just this cycle of violence continuing. And so what we have to look to help people understand it is who is the beneficiary of this policy. And it's really the permanent war economy. It's the Pentagon. It's the corporate and banking elites in the United States who stand to profit off of the continued U.S. control of Iraqi oil, of this universally accepted in the ruling circles strategic asset for the United States. And so for our part, we say that just like people stood up to the war in Iraq at the time of the Gulf War in 1990 and 1991, just as we built a massive U.S. anti-war movement in 2002 and 2003, and after that against the occupation of Iraq, now we have to build an anti-war movement against this new U.S. intervention in Iraq and Syria. So the anti-coalition believes that this upcoming spring mobilization, which has actions beginning in D.C. on March 18th and culminates in a rally in March at the White House on Saturday, March 21st, is a very important step towards building that movement. We're very happy to be working with a number of different anti-war and social justice organizations on that mobilization, and we encourage all activists, all progressive-minded people from across the U.S. to mobilize to be in D.C. For that action, and especially for the Saturday, March 21st rally in March at the White House, so that we can build a new movement, so that we can show that the people of the United States are going to take a stand against this U.S. intervention, no matter what various explanations are used to justify it, whatever promises are going to make. We're going to recognize it for what it actually is, which is this continuing, now decades-old intervention on the part of the United States in Iraq and throughout the Middle East.
All right, Sarah, we'll see you in D.C. next month.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter.